Hi guys, welcome to the second episode of Fire Mafia. We are back. I'm Giorgio, also known as Mr. Rip, blogger at retiringprogress.com and also YouTuber since a couple of weeks on my small channel. And here we have Angelo. Angelo?
Hi. Also blogger and YouTuber at my channel Peer-to-Peer Investing Europe. And yeah, today we're going to be talking about where to start investing. Because we thought it's good to have an introduction and to talk about our views on investing and to give you a bit of an idea on where to get started, strategizing, what broker to choose, passive investing, why we believe or why we may not believe which direction is best. Then what you can automate, if it makes sense to invest over time or maybe do like a lump sum investment. And then rebalancing, and in the end we're going to talk a little bit about taxes as well in different countries.
So I'm going to give you Switzerland and work in Switzerland. Angelo lives and work in Austria. We're both Italians, so we might touch topics that are either shared or completely different among countries. For example, in Switzerland we don't have a capital gain tax, but we have a wealth tax, maybe in Italy or in Austria. The situation is different, so we might touch those specific issues. So, Angelo, last time we discussed about the concept of financial independence, and we say that there are few strategies. For example, the passive investment strategies that we're going to touch today. Then there are other strategies like real estate investing, alternative assets, or active investing, or whatever. So today we are going to talk about the passive investing strategy, which is the one that both I and Angelo employ for the most part of our portfolios. So each of us, we have other bets in our portfolios, but I think the core is passive investing. Do you agree with me?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah,
the bulk by far is passive.
So why do you think that passive investing is the best, I mean, or is the most safe, or is the least costly in terms of mental energy? So there are many aspects of why passive investing is a good strategy. What do you think is the reason why you and I and everybody should pick passive investing?
So I think so for us it's like if we just look back the longest possible time frame that we have. And we look at studies that have been made as well on active versus passive investments. We realize that most people that try to active, like now, right now we're talking about stock investments for the most part. So we're talking about the stock market. And there we can see that it's very, very unlikely to outperform the market with an active strategy over the long run. So I'm not saying over 2 years, but over 5 or 10 years or more. And so the question is, in that case, if you can't outperform, then the easiest strategy is to just buy the market and pay as low fees as possible. Because another problem with active strategies is that you have, either if you do it yourself, you have fees when buying and selling most of the time. And then, of course, we're not even talking about the tax implications. We're going to get to that later. But you also usually pay some professional fund manager. And so you have a high fees of maybe 2% or something per year, which is eating into your performance. It can make a big difference over the long term.
Well, there are also robo-advisor, which they are kind of occupying a gray area where you can have some professional entity which is handling your money passively, and they will charge you between 0.5 and 1%. So first we want to try to explain why we think that passive investing is better, but then how to implement a passive investing strategy that can be done on your own, so with no cost, or you can employ someone to help you with passive investing. I personally think that the costs, even of a robo advisor over a long term, even if it's at 0.5%, and you hardly will find that 0.5% robo advisor today. They're closer to 1% unless you have like a lot of money. The integrated cost, the cost over your investing lifetime of a 0.5% fee, if you aim to reach 1 million, it's in the order of several, like you may reach like hundreds of thousands of euros. So it's like you need to take a car every day to go to work? Would you like get a driving license or go Uber every day? With the difference that a Uber ride, the cost is constant over a lifetime, while 0.5% or 1% on your portfolio over 30 or 40 years, it accumulates to a lot of money. Okay, so we advocate for a self-made solution. So for handle your portfolio on your own. But let me advise you one thing, that it's a bit time intensive. So if you are a businessman and you have no time and your time is very precious, maybe it's worth investigating other options. But if you just want to start investing and you actually want to learn the tools, like learning how to invest on your own should be a must.
Yeah, definitely. Especially if investing on your own means maybe buying single stocks rather than a passive ETF, then you definitely need to invest a lot more time as well.
Yeah, sure. While if you just want to buy ETFs or other passive tools, the time cost might not be that much. There is a little bit of a steep curve. So at the beginning, you need to learn few things, like how to enter an order or a broker, what is a brokerage platform, what is an ETF, which ETF to choose that tracks your index, and how to build your portfolio made of different indexes, probably. Because you're never 100% passive. You are 100% passive if you started investing at your birthday, like a birth date, and you invested in the entire market until you die. You always have to do some activity, and we are going to see it. Yeah, I think the future, what they are talking in the financial like forums, is that in the end you will reach your own personal index that tracks your risk attitude, your some percentage of what are your bets. Like, I want to be a bit overexposed to emerging markets, or a bit overexposed to dividend stocks, or a bit overexposed toward the US or Europe or small cap. So, but in the end, you build your own personal index, which is then passive, but building this index is a bit of an active action.
Okay, so maybe we should give you an introduction first, what an index is in the first place. So let's say if we are talking about the S&P 500 index, which is very popular, and I hear a lot of people mention it, even in Europe, and that's an index. So that's basically tracking the US stock market on a market cap basis.
If you buy a share of the S&P 500 index, which is, by the way, a basket of goods defined by Standard & Poor's, and what's in this basket? There are shares of the top 500 companies. Actually, there are 505 different shares, because some companies have more than one share. For example, Berkshire Hathaway or Google, they have more shares, more different kind of listed shares. So in the end, each company will get a proportion in the basket, in the index, that's proportional to their market cap. So you have enough Apple, Amazon, Tesla, Google, whatever. And the larger one company is, we're not talking about the face value of a stock. So the larger a company is, the bigger their market cap, the bigger their presence in an index. So when you buy a share of S&P 500, you are betting on the entire large cap market of US. So if one company goes up, the other goes down, your share will go up or down based on the average, weighted average direction of the daily market. And that resulted in the last 100, S&P 500 is probably up only since 1920 something, but we have indexes even
Dow Jones,
before,
I think,
like
before.
Dow Jones from 1870. So in the last 150 years, on average, the index value has grown after inflation about 7%, or before inflation around 10%. So those are historical data. Of course, historical data are no guarantee of future returns, but historically, the market went up. Of course, you have you have fluctuations. You have like even decades when the market is in drawdown. So for example, after the dot-com bubble in 2002, like starting in year 2000, the market went down for a lot. Then when it started recovering, there were the great financial crisis, and then went down again. But if you were holding since year 2000 today, you would still have experienced a good return. Yeah. In the short term, it can go down. In the long term, it has gone up so far by a predictable amount. Like over 30 years, there's no period where an index like S&P 500 returned than less than 5% annualized per year. So that's the history. Yeah. And if you know me, if you go on my blog, you will see that I challenge all these assumptions. But let's talk about the theory and the basics. So in the long term, stocks go up simply because the human race is evolving and building new things. And I imagine a future in 100 years where we are colonizing planets. So we are not at the peak of our global wealth.
Yeah. And also another thing that we should mention is that an index has another nice function, is that it's kind of self-cleansing, which means that if you invest into single stocks, you don't know the company could go bankrupt. But if you invest into an entire so either the world stock market or the US stock market, then other new companies that are more profitable, that are more innovative, are going to come and join the index, companies that cannot innovate over time, that just have a worse, that earn less over time, they're going to fall out of the index. They're going to be worth less. So you have a little bit of an effect, a cleaning effect that you don't have when you invest into single stocks.
Yeah, this is a double-edged sword, because sometimes if you track a large cap index, you get only stocks if a startup is going crazily up, you only get it in the S&P after the first initial like 10x. But then, I mean, this is like all short-term reasoning. In the long term, investing in the global market, it's a good idea. So now S&P 500 is the large cap US. You can extend this and have the entire US market, and there are indexes who track the entire US market. And then why stop at the US market? You might want to invest in the world. You might want to say, I want a fraction of each company listed everywhere. So this is the most passive way you can be. And there are ETFs that track indexes that are on the entire world market of stocks or bonds or whatever. What is an ETF, Angelo? I heard this term like mentioned by myself 5 seconds ago, but I forgot.
So ETF stands for exchange traded fund. And it's an index fund that you can trade on exchanges. It's just more liquid, so you can buy and sell it at any time while the market is open, or even after market hours on different
brokers. Dangerous.
And that also means that you can see the price change all the time. So that's something that, for example, you don't have if you buy like an apartment or a real estate or something. Mm. So people feel safer. Yeah, exactly. Just because they don't see how prices is changing. Otherwise, so people would freak out.
The concept of tracking indexes started 40, 50 years ago, probably by Vanguard. But at the beginning, there were only mutual funds. So you go somewhere, you give money to these guys, and then they invest your money, and they will tell you how much your shares are worth. Maybe at the end of the day, you can redeem your money. There's a process sometimes involved. You always have to interact with the entity issuing the fund. Now with exchange traded funds, those funds go online. They go on a stock exchange. So Vanguard, for example, or iShares, or State Street, or Spider, they issue fund and then say, okay, there are 1,000 shares. Now play your game. So you can buy shares from someone else, and the price is always listed on the stock exchange. And the price is always reflecting the value of the underlying assets, because else someone would benefit and arbitrage. So there are like anti-arbitrage mechanisms to prevent that. So in the end, okay, owning an ETF that tracks an index means owning the index. And that's what passive investors do. So now the question is, Okay, you convinced me. It seems smart. I want to own some index, but how should I start even thinking about like my asset allocation, for example? So what should you do? That's a very personal topic. First of all, this is not financial advice, like giga disclaimer. We are having fun talking. We have no vested interest in any of the products we will eventually discuss. And asset allocation. Nice topic. Where should we start?
So I think the first thing before you think about your asset allocation is setting aside a couple months of living expenses before you even think about investing. I think that's the first thing that's going to make you feel also more relaxed about your investments. Mm-hmm. Because if you go all in 100% just investments, and then you need the money, and then you maybe have to sell at a bad time, it's not the best strategy. So I think we have to talk about asset allocation. What's important is, first of all, your age. How old, young are you? If you're young, you can also you could go higher risk because you say, I have a longer time horizon. So I have less problems if there's a big drawdown over a longer period of time, because this is something that's out of our control. So we can just do based on probability what gives us the best chance of having good returns on our money, on our investments. So, and if you're older and you're right before the pension and you might want to use that money, then you should reduce your risk. So this is something you should keep in mind when defining your asset allocation.
And yeah, what would you even say? Taking a step above, I would say that before even thinking about those things, you should first clarify your objectives. So what are you investing for? What are your goals? You just want to, see your money grow, or you have a target, you want to buy a house in 10 years, you want to pay for future vacations, or you want to afford your children's education and that's costly. You should have an expectations of your future cash flow somehow, even a rough expectations. You should say, okay, I have a job, I have this salary, I have these expenses, I have a gap. I expect this gap to grow, to shrink. I expect that in 5 years I will need 50,000 as a down payment for a house. You should first do an assessment of your, where are you right now? So what are your net worth? What are your expenses? What are your income sources? And then what are future expected expenses like this? Then this is the first step. So get to know yourself and your financial self. Second, I would also say that you should assess your risk tolerance, because this is another that's a huge mistake that I've done on first place. I never assessed my risk tolerance, and I'm learning it the hard way. I'm learning my risk tolerance on the market, and so 2020 hit me in the face a couple of times, and I say, okay, maybe I'm not that risk prone. I'm more risk averse. I don't know. So you should assess your risk tolerance. How to do this? I think the best way is to prototype, is to just try. Try invest something even a bit crazy and see how you feel if it drops 50%, how you feel if it doubles, or if you just get plus 10%, then you sell and you are wanted to cash. You bought a Bitcoin at $100, and then when it was $200, you cashed it, and now you are regretting. There are many emotions at play: greed, fear, overconfidence. There are several emotions at play, but this is probably behavioral investing is another topic for another day. But in the end, before even hitting the first order on your broker, you should think about your risk assessment, your risk tolerance, and where are you right now? So financial intelligence, awareness. We can set up a fictional case study. Now, let's say you are out of college and you started your first job, and then you see that you have some low expenses and a nice income. So you might save €1,000 per month. Let's make this example. You started from zero, or let's make it more complete. Let's say you started with 50K because your poor grandma sadly is not among us anymore, and she left you 50,000 euros, and with your job you are now earning 1,000 per month. This is after expenses. So you have this problem at hand. You are 25, and what are your goals? Let's say, for example, this is fire mafia, so it's not Lamborghini mafia. So I assume that if you are listening to us, your goal is to retire at one point or reach financial independence. Let's say early retirement. Let's keep it on the side. Let's say I want to feel comfortable at one point. So I'm 25. My horizon is very long, and so that's the situation. What would you do first? Let's list the options, for example. First of all, I'm 25 years old. I want to invest not like a boomer. So I have a boomer side of me who wants to invest in stocks and bonds. Are they even a thing? And then I want to invest. I want to bet a bit on cryptos and other crazy stuff. So where would I start? For example, I would start from, what are my living expenses and how much do I need as a emergency fund? First, you should ask yourself, okay, how stable is my job? Has my country where I live or work, has any safety net if I lose my job tomorrow? So that should influence your emergency fund. Like in Switzerland, people, like when I was working at Google, there were a current of people saying, I need zero emergency fund. Why do I need an emergency fund? I mean, if I lose my job, there's unemployment. I have a steady cash flow. So next month, if I need 5K, I have it. so this is like, I'm conservative. So I like to see a bit of cash like on the side. So, but usually it's never more than 5 or 6 months of living expenses. No?
Yeah.
So for our fictional character, let's say 2000 net salary, 1000 expenses. So 1000 extra per month. You may want to have 5K, maybe 10K if you plan some expenses in the future. Let's say you are a video game streamer and there are new console coming out, or your PC is like crap, so you want to buy a streaming PC for 3,000 euros. So that's known expenses, so you probably want to account for that separately.
I think in that situation, yeah, you can probably take on more risks than somebody who's older. If you have, again, that's depending on your goals, what you want to do. Maybe you married and you want to buy a house soon, then it's a different thing. Then you might want to collect more cash and not risk that amount, that money on the market, because you can't foresee the returns exactly. Maybe you wanted to buy a house in March 2020 and it was not the best time if you invested in the stock market before.
And so as you can see, we want to talk about investments, but before that, there's a lot of like research and question you should ask yourself before even touching the asset allocation, which should come next, essentially.
And so maybe you say, okay, I'm young, I don't want to buy a house right away. And then you can go into higher risk and you define your asset allocation and say, okay, I have a long time horizon. I'm going to put 90% basically of my investable capital into risk assets, which in our case, I think two of us agree that the stock market gives you the highest probability of good returns over the long run.
Oh, Dogecoin. Dogecoin gives me more better returns.
Or if you go all in on GameStop, I'm sure that's a fantastic idea. That's
well, work out for everybody. Late, probably. But anyway, so our fictional character had like 50,000 and 1,000 per month. So how would I start if I were recommending this person how to invest? I would say, let's say 5K aside. 10K, whatever. Let's say 5K, then 45K at end. Other 5K, bet. Do whatever you like. Like have fun and feel the pain of losses. Like learn who you are with those 5K. And other 40K, this is your pension fund. This is like the beginning of your future pension that can happen if you're lucky in another 10 or 15 or 20 years, which will be like another couple of decades before normal people retire. But you should treat them like that's locked. I'm going to invest them and never touch for the next 20 years. Okay, so this is first. We're not going to talk what to do with the 5K in your emergency fund. And we're not going to talk what to do with the 5K you're going to waste on shit. Okay, you have 40K and 1K per month. Let's say that the 5K experimentations, they don't get any extra funding from the 1K per month, or might actually get like 10%. So you save 1,000 per month, 900 goes to your plan, your pension plan, and 100 goes to your fund money. The risk of having fund money is that maybe you get lucky. Maybe you bet on Dogecoin, it goes 10x, and now you have the same fund money than your pension fund. So at that point, I would recommend to rebalance and keep your fund money small. You've been lucky, don't think you're skilled, don't double down, don't sell your stocks to buy more Dogecoins. So if you want to play, everybody wants to play, keep fund money under control. Okay, then you have, okay, now we're going to discuss about the core, okay, the pension fund. Okay, now we have to invest 40K and 1K per month. There are two philosophies for the lump sum you have right now. There is the define your asset allocation and drop all your money as soon as you have it. So you drop 40K all at once and then you keep investing 1K per month. Or even spread your initial 40K over a period of time. The first one is called lump sum investing. The second one is called dollar cost averaging. There are also other intermediary techniques which are value averaging, but that's micro optimization. Well, unless you got 10 million as an inheritance, in that case, you might want to be to micro optimize. What are your thoughts about that lump sum versus DCA?
Yeah, it's difficult because you can't foresee the future. But what we've seen is that usually lump sum still gives you the best probability of the best returns over a long run, that usually dollar cost averaging doesn't work out. We're saying usually, of course, because whatever, every year can be different. But since the market tends to go up over time as a result, usually it makes more sense to do a lump sum investing. But like, if it makes you sleep better, then you can invest in baby steps. You can do, for example, you can divide it into six pieces and invest it over time.
I like once that again, we are on probably on a different, like, you are the young, I'm the old, so I have slightly different opinions. But yeah, please go on.
So personally, I think lump sum is still the way to go. The problem is when you're in that situation, then it's a different feeling than in theory. And I understand, like, with the market is at all time highs, it doesn't feel the best. But there are some really nice graphs where you can see how often the market is at all-time highs. Maybe I can include that here. And you will see that in most years, you reach an all-time high or something. So a lot of people before you already thought, oh, I should wait. I should just like the last crash, people were waiting. I'm sure it's going to go lower. And then they didn't.
I'm here.
You see, even if you're experienced, that can happen to you.
Yeah, and, I can share a bit of my experience and then my thoughts, and then how my thoughts and my actions are not exactly in sync and how I feel about that. So first, my experience. I'm very good at holding, even doubling down when things are going bad. So during March last year, we are almost at the 1 year celebration of the market bottom, which was on the 23rd or 24th of March, I don't remember. So it's probably when this podcast is going to be published. And so while it was going down, I was buying more and actually thinking I was getting good deals. I remember at the bottom on the 23rd or 24th March, I remember buying an ETF that tracks the entire world, that's VT, and it was 35% less than its market high. And I said, okay, if this reaches market high, like all-time high in 5 years, it would be equivalent to earning 8% per year. Well, where should I sign? I mean, that's perfect. I'm okay earning 8% per year. And I think that all the craziness around this pandemic, it was March 2020. So at like when there were like tanks carrying corpses in Bergamo and there were like famous pictures and we thought the world was doomed. But we knew it was like transient. It was not like a Black Mirror episode. So I said, okay, I think we are going to reach an all-time high in 5 years at least. So I'm okay. I'm investing everything at this moment. If it goes below, it's okay. In 5 years, it will be back. We went back in 4 months. So after 4 months, I made like back to all-time high. So my investments at the bottom returned 40, 45% in 4 months. I say this is now this is not rational in the other way. So I don't think we are already at the market high while there are still people dying on the street and shops closed. So I felt like I'm not confident. So I sold. So I kind of quit the market, 90% quit the market in August 2020.
But then the market went up. One more thing we should mention again is, remember, in Switzerland, you don't have capital gains taxes. So for motivation than for somebody else.
Sure.
Because you don't have a penalty for doing that.
Yeah, which is actually making things worse on the behavioral side. Yes, with no capital gain tax and essentially cheap broker fees, you have more options, and options are bad. So I sold. Now I'm slowly re-entering the market. Now I'm in a situation where I have a lot of money sitting, and I'm slowly putting money back into the market, like doing a dollar cost average, essentially. So my thoughts are, of course, lump sum investing from a mathematical point of view should return the highest expected return on your money. But it has like slightly higher volatility, because if you tomorrow invest all your money and the market drops 50%, yeah, if you invest a bit each month for the next year or two, you also buy at the bottom. So on average, you lose money, but you reduce volatility. So it's a really personal situation. So our friend with 40,000 to invest, let's say that he decided to invest all at once. Okay. Now, time to have an asset allocation. Okay. An asset allocation. First of all, asset classes. There are several asset classes. There are stocks. I don't think we need to explain what stocks, bonds, commodities are. I hope people know. So there are stocks, there are bonds, there are commodities like precious metals, for example. There are derivatives that we are not going to touch now. We don't recommend for people, like, we don't recommend it. Let's limit to stock, bonds, and commodities, even though at the moment I don't invest in gold or other commodities. So let's say stock and bonds, okay, which are the traditional portfolio split, stock and bonds. Also bonds. That's complicated. That's really, really complicated.
Especially in Europe when you have negative rates.
Yes, yes. So these are really bad. So the problem here is that essentially if you're young, there are no alternative. There's no alternative to investing in stocks or other things. Holding cash, you might hold more cash, but let's now focus on investing in stocks. Let's not touch the entire asset allocation. So you should sit down and think about, okay, how much of your money I want to spend, I want to invest in stocks, how much in other asset classes. Mm-hmm. And yeah, let's say this guy is 25 years old. Let's say I'm going 100% stocks, which is dangerous, especially at those all-time high. They're going to come back frequently, but maybe for a while we might experience a bear market. But let's say, okay, let's go 100% in stocks. What are next steps?
So next step is we need a broker where we can invest into stocks. So that's okay, something we wanted to talk about, because we also got some questions about this topic.
Okay, yeah, sure. But before that, I would like to remove the last pebble in the shoes.
Sure.
How would you invest 100% in stocks? Would you buy a single ETF that tracks the entire world? Or would you spend some time thinking about your personal index? That's something which probably for the 25 years old who just got the inheritance and want to start, I would not over-engineerize this. I would just drop the money on a world index at first. Yeah. Then with time, with more money, with more knowledge, if there is some passion also, one might research personalize a bit the index. Like say I want more exposure on this or on that. because the world index is essentially 55% US, 35% the rest of the developed countries, and 10% emerging markets.
And 13% emerging already.
How much?
13 already.
13 already? Oh, thanks, China. Okay, good. Last time I checked, it was like 8 or 9, 10%. Okay. And if it is market cap driven, you are almost only influenced by large cap stocks. So there, you might want to add something, but you are at the beginning. You are 25 years old. You are going to work for a while and you're going to earn more money. So that's just to start. So let's say we want to invest everything in a world stock index that tracks everything. Now you cannot, I mean, they don't sell it at the newspaper kiosk, no?
Yeah.
They don't sell it even at your bank, or maybe.
But usually it's packaged in an active, with active costs. They're not gonna recommend it to you directly.
Custody fees, high transaction fees, and only their product. They are the real mafia. Buy this fund from my bank. I sign here. It's only, I have 3% expensive ratio, but you don't care. So there are banks who sell products. They're getting better. They know that the competition is like crazy, with broker being more accessible and knowledge being spread. So the banks are trying to find money from old people that have a lot of money. But if you are 20, 25, 30, you are the small fish. They won't try to catch you down. So you are young. You can play with brokers and whatever. So the difference between a broker and a bank, also in terms of security, there is some difference. Like, banks are a bit more regulated, but brokers also are.
I think again, this is one thing that people don't know a lot about, and there's a lot miscommunication in a way. That people think, okay, if I buy my ETF at the bank, then my funds are insured up to 100,000 euro, even though that is just on cash. That has nothing to do with the ETFs stocks.
Sure.
Because that is always held separately. It's another thing. It's always held separately. Points. So even if they go bankrupt, because the bank basically owns your money, the cash that you put there, if they go bankrupt, that's why you have the security system where it's insured up to 100,000. But with stocks, ETFs, those are held separately in segregated accounts, where if they go bankrupt, they have to be able to transfer it to your new broker or whatever. So again, there are a lot of differences.
We should discuss this, because those are usually the things that nobody talks about. Okay, what do you actually own when you open an account to a broker, you send them the money, and you click on an order on an ETF? Pam. You then you see your UI and say, oh, cool, I have 100 shares of this fund. There are several things you probably should know. And maybe then at one point, like, not care, but you should know. First of all, there is a broker. The broker is an entity you send money to, and you expect to get money back when you sell your shares or you transfer your shares. Brokers have regulations. Sometimes they are not sitting next to you. I mean, your bank, you probably know, your bank institution is probably on your street. You can go there, meet people. The broker usually are not like that available. They have customer service, so you can interact with them and whatever. The cash you have with them, it's usually stored in banks somewhere. Sometimes not under your name. Sometimes it's like bank accounts under their name, and then they have a record. So if they go broke, that's a bit of an issue. So if your bank goes broke, you are protected in one way. If your broker goes broke, you are protected in another way. It depends on the country where your broker is operating, in your country of residence, and rules. But for the moment, let's say that in Europe, cash on brokers is covered by the same protection of banks. I'm not sure, because I'm not living in Europe.
It depends on the broker. For example, one Austrian brokerage that I use, and my wife as well, is called Flatex, and they have a banking license as well. So the cash is covered by the banking license. And the assets are it's the different security. So that's anyway segregated. And that has the European, investor compensation or something like this. Mm-hmm. Based on each country, it has some differences. And also, I think the same thing is DEGIRO. Now they're introducing this, since they were purchased from Flatex. So now it's called Flatex DEGIRO Bank. And so they're also introducing the basically this security, this added bank security on your cash, and then the separate investments. Yeah.
About the assets you own, so the if you buy an ETF, if you buy individual stocks, those are of course segregated. I try to track down what actually means. I try to call, I don't know, Vanguard and say, hey, my name is blah, 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 and I have a lot of shares of your ETFs. Is there somewhere written in your records that I exist? Or if my broker goes like belly up and the apps don't connect, what are next steps? I discovered the existence of custody banks. So usually a company, let's say Coca-Cola, they issue shares, and there are banks who are called custody banks that they keep track of who owns what. And at their level, probably the custody bank only knows that this broker has these shares, okay? And then the broker has internal records that are segregated. So there is a bit of a problem. This is just saying, but that's not a problem you would avoid investing with banks. Like with banks, it's the same. So if I buy my share of a Vanguard fund from my Post Finance bank, it's the same. At Vanguard, they won't know my name, and at the custody bank, they won't know my name. So there is another custody bank between the broker and the custody bank of the companies that should track this. This is a bit complicated. I tried to follow a small rabbit hole a few months ago. I didn't see the end of it. I will dig deeper. But right now, let's say that among all other investment options you have right now, if you want to buy crypto on some exchange or P2P lending, we are in the most regulated world ever. And so far, I've heard no one getting scammed by a fake broker. You get scammed if you give your money to Bernie Madoff, I mean, to individual investors who promise you high return. Here in the passive world, the largest brokers are too big to fail. And I mean, there's enough protections that if the cases where this doesn't work is when probably they're bombing your apartment for other reasons, or there's a zombie apocalypse. So probably money won't matter much.
We should turn a bit more positive, because it's still called the Financial Independence Retire Early Mafia podcast. And so we want you to get motivated to start investing, because over the long run, you're going to be, I think, further down the line, you're going to be so glad that you started at some point. So these are just, we're going into a lot of detail right here down the rabbit hole, which is when you spend a lot of time on it, then you just go really deep, and it's a very complex topic. But luckily, this is a well-regulated market.
Okay.
So if you go with well-known names of brokers, like you should be as safe as possible in this space. Now, another thing is...
Next step is
So it's another thing if you go with some no-name broker somewhere in some small island somewhere, then if you don't really know, okay, do I really own the shares? Am I really buying the shares, or am I buying a derivative on the shares? So these are all things that you should know beforehand.
Yeah.
And so now we're going to talk about brokers next, because I think this fits in well. And I'm actually going to mention two brokers first that I don't like, and why, because I got this question. So the first one is eToro, because you see a lot of eToro advertisements on YouTube. So I think this is a good one to mention. And this one, as far as I know, when you buy shares there, apart from having higher spreads, I think, I'm not sure how the ownership works exactly, because the problem is you can't really transfer shares from one broker to another. And this is a problem if, for example, you want to switch broker, maybe the conditions are getting worse there, or whatever other reason you're not happy with them, and you can't transfer them without selling and then getting your money out and then buying the same thing again. Again, there you have risks of getting in and out at the right time.
And also triggering like capital gain tax where it applies.
Yeah. In addition, you have the taxation right away, which if you want to invest long term, you want to avoid that as long as possible to keep your money invested so you don't lose a chunk of your money just on taxes, even though you don't need it already. And the same thing, I think, applies on trading 212 as well, which is another free broker where you don't have trading fees directly. And so a lot of young investors see these brokers, and it seems really attractive because you don't have fees, or very low fees when buying and selling. It's very easy to buy and sell. And so there, as far as I know, they say that their shares are held in custody via Interactive Brokers. Mm-hmm. However, you still cannot transfer them. And for the last couple of years, they've been promising to be able to transfer the shares. And I don't know, for me, it doesn't make me sleep well with these things. So maybe it's good for if you want to play around with something, it might be okay. But for long-term investments, I would go with something that's that we know more about and we have all the features that, in my opinion, are important for a long-term investment strategy, and not promised features in the future, but you already have them at the time when you open your brokerage account and when you make that decision. And as far as I know, you're at Interactive Brokers, right?
Yes, sure. Yeah, I grew up as an investor in Switzerland, and the option, the local options here are pretty expensive. Either you have Corner Trader or SwissQuote, they are expensive. They ask you, like, trade fees are pretty high. I was working at Google, and at Google there's like this intelligence team on super Uber optimization. And most of the people there were using Interactive Brokers. I did my research. I read a lot of internal news. And in the end, I decided to trust this entity. And so far, so good. It's in business since 40 years, something like that. And it is one of the so-called discount brokers. There are two or three. It's US-based. And essentially, every possible fee is reduced to the very minimum. This is meant for people with some experience. So their offer is amazing if you have at least $100,000 with them. If you have less, you might be, you will pay some monthly custody fee, which is, by the way, deducted by transaction costs. So right now it's for the normal account. Now maybe Angelo knows more about other alternative accounts with IB. Yeah. With the normal account, you have to pay minimum of $10 per month in fees. If you do some trades and transactions and you pay, let's say, $5 in fees, you pay the other $5. You always reach 10, unless you spend more, of course. I say dollar because IB is US based. And the trading currency, their rules are expressed in US dollars, but he can hold you whatever currency you have. Yeah. Every currency you upload on IB or when you sell and buy shares, it's just one asset that you have. While with other brokers, you are forced to use a single currency. For example, with the Giro or other brokers, you are forced to use a single currency. With IB, you can own whatever. You can have like Canadian dollars. Why not? I buy on the market Canadian dollars and I hold on.
Yeah, you can set up different currency accounts as well.
Yeah, sure. I have usually three currencies. Maybe even a fourth. Sometimes I bought British pounds, but I by default I have dollars, euros, and Swiss francs. So IB is very cheap for currency conversion. You go on the market and you convert the money at the market price. They brag of having less than half a basis point of spread in currency conversion, which means 0.005% spread, and at like a $2 fixed cost almost.
So you shouldn't convert $10. In that case, it wouldn't make
no,
sense.
No, yeah, exactly. Yeah. No. I mean, that's at least like $1,000 to make it reasonable. Yeah. And then like trading fees are extremely low for US-based funds. I mean, here there's a lot of other things we can say about buying US funds versus non-US funds, and it depends strongly on the regulation of your country. I'm in Switzerland, and in Switzerland we are allowed to buy US funds. In the rest of Europe, probably you can't.
No, and that's the problem. Yeah. A lot of people see the financial independence videos or articles from US bloggers, and then they look for the US funds. And so if you're in Switzerland, you're lucky, you can buy those directly if you want. If you're in the rest of Europe, it's a lot harder and not
maybe
really usually advised.
Even But of course, I mean, outside of Europe.
Yeah, exactly.
So those are the brokers we use. I mean, I use Interactive Brokers. There are, if you're in Switzerland or in UK, you can attach yourself to the IB UK variant, which is still totally American. If you're in the rest of Europe, there are three other offices, but under European laws, so with less products available, like probably lower protection and whatever. But I think it's still good. I don't know. I'm using the IB UK still.
So I can talk about the rest of Europe.
Yeah, cool.
Because they recently moved also my own account from IB UK to IB Ireland.
Oh no!
But yeah, I know. That's I already talked with some people who have a lot of clients, because before I had my account via an introducing broker, TradeStation Global, and sadly they did not get a European license in time, and so they had to move all customers from the UK to Ireland, and basically at that point I was just an IB customer, so I had to pay the I would have had to pay the $10 monthly inactivity fee. And so I contacted CapTrader, which is another introducing broker.
CapTrader, yes.
Yeah, and I'm very happy with them, because so the only difference from an actual direct IB account and opening an account there is you need an account minimum of 2,000 euro or $2,000 or 2,000 Swiss francs to open an account. And they make their money on the trading fees. So that means you don't have a $10 inactivity fee, which I think for most long-term investors that maybe invest 2,000 euro per month or something, doesn't make a lot of sense, because there's no way you're going to reach this amount of trading fees on such a low amount of investments.
Yeah.
And so you have a slightly higher trading fee, but like in my case, when I buy the Vanguard ETF, it was 2 euro for a 2,000 euro order on the European exchange. And so for me, it's still very low. So maybe if you trade some
2 euro on 2,000 euros.
Yeah.
Okay.
So 0.1%. It's 0.1%. Yeah.
It's probably a couple of order of magnitude larger than IB trading US funds. I think I moved 100,000 euros for less than $1, but yeah.
And what I wanted to say, so now my account is on IB Ireland, and a lot of others were also moved to either IB Ireland, or if you're in Eastern Europe, then IB Central Europe, which is in Hungary.
So Hungary, yeah.
And some people weren't super happy about that, because they think that, okay, since let's say maybe they're less predictable from a government perspective or something like this.
Okay.
But the thing is, we still have IB on top of all of this, so I'm less worried about this. So also now we have the European investor protection instead of the US investor protection, which is better. The thing
you
is,
think so?
It's better. Yeah, I mean, at least from the amounts that are given. So in the US, you have up to 250,000 euro or up to, and then cash as well. The only thing is, when you actually look into the ICE IPC insurance and how much they have, like in a pool, in the end, it's still, they would have to fill it up. You know, it's like based on all the assets.
Okay. IB UK, I mean, IB US, there is the SICP, which SIPC. Is the security insurance, whatever,
protection.
The American law that says everybody's going to get 250K, plus IB signed an insurance with Lloyd, I think, but that's ridiculous. That's a ridiculous amount. So that's just for PR. They just say, hey, we also have an extra insurance of like up to 10 million euros, everybody combined, which is like probably peanuts. But I think, and by the way, if protections need to be triggered, it means something really bad happened, probably in the economy. So I'm not sure the governments are able, unless they're going to print more money and say, okay, you want more money? I print them and give it to you. And it's a hyperinflation, like 250,000 US dollars, if you can buy a banana. I don't know.
Once again, it wouldn't, even if IB goes bankrupt, it wouldn't need to trigger the protection, because these assets are held separately again.
Okay.
So the protection is only if they can't recover your assets because, I don't know, some crazy...
we are trying to protect against Machiavelli here. I mean, if a company just goes belly up because, hey, we are out of business, bye-bye, now do your stuff in liquidation to get your asset back, that should be fine. But if the company is run by a Madoff, by someone who want to try to screw you, there are protections for that as well. So the silo, the separation of assets, like it's a protection against like a malicious entity. By default, when companies go bankrupt, they're not necessarily malicious. So if things go bankrupt the normal way, you should like be 100% sure you get everything. Now we are on a broker. Okay, I signed in, thanks to you, Angelo and Giorgio, that recommended those brokers. But by the way, we are going to put some links in the description, and we have affiliation probably. I have affiliation with IB.
I also have an affiliation
with IB. But how can I say? I'm not recommending IB because the affiliation. I would recommend it anyway. But if you sign using our codes, you probably get some. I don't know. I think you get some money or free shares or something like this, and we get something as well. Now we are on a broker. Cool. What's next?
Yeah, so now we have the broker, and again, here it's a country-specific thing. So I want to mention, since I know many people who are following me also are from Austria or Germany, and if you're in Austria and Germany, then we have very specific, very complex tax laws. And in that case, I would really recommend going with a local broker rather and save yourself the headaches. So for example, in Austria, you have basically one broker which has basically no competition from a cost perspective, and that's Flatex, the bank that I mentioned before, the Flatex broker. And because there you can have a free brokerage account, and then you can even put up savings plans and then buy an ETF for either free once per month or like €1.50 for an ETF purchase. And you can automate it very easily. And they take care of the taxes for you, which is a huge advantage. So you don't have to deal with anything else. So either dividends or capital gains and things like this. Because otherwise, you would have to do file your tax returns. And I think for most people, that's a lot that's of annoying. Hassle, especially if they don't have to do it if they're employed. Then they're like, okay, now I just because of this shit. And and if you're in Germany, also there you have, I think you have very good options there. A lot of low-cost brokers that are well-regulated. Like some off the top of my head are Smart Broker. You can also use Flatex, but there they actually do have an account fee. So some percentage of your funds that are invested, which I would always avoid whenever possible.
The custody fee is the worst. I mean, you should avoid any. Usually banks, they have custody fees for the funds which are not issued by the bank. So that's the real mafia.
So remember, Flatex Austria is good. Flatex Germany, not so much. And then you also have Scalable Capital and some others like Trade Republic. But there, I think you have more iShares or something, ETF, some more BlackRock stuff. And so these are some tips. And I'm going to put the link down below.
Let's say we pick the broker. I mean, our guy pick the broker and say, okay, I'm going to invest with whatever. Let's say Interactive Brokers or CapTrader or DeGiro or whatever. And now, okay, should I wire them the money? I'm scared. Yeah, you should do. You should do. They are. You did the research. You trusted this, and then you are wiring your money to them. You're probably going to set up like a monthly recurring like wire transfer. Some brokers require that you initiate the transfer, announcing it on the IB requires that you initiate the transfer by telling IB that you are going to move money. And then, okay, now you have money, you have real money on your brokerage account. First thing is to, now you need to define your asset allocation. But we just say that for simplicity, for this podcast, we're going to invest 100% on a world ETF. Where do I find one? Do you have any tool to, I heard this, I don't know. Where do I find a good ETF?
So a good website that I like to use is just etf.com. And there you can type in, like you can either select directly an index and you want to find the ETFs for that index, or you can type in S&P 500, you can type in MSCI World or Vanguard, FTC All World, and you can find all these ETFs. And you can also find more details if they're accumulating, if they're distributing, so if they're paying out dividends regularly, or if they're reinvesting the dividends.
Do we want to list some of the characteristics of an ETF? You should care about what index it is tracking, of course. And it should match with your intention. Okay. So for the entire world, there are few indexes. One is from MSCI. There is the MSCI World, which is only developed countries, 23 countries. There is MSCI All Country World, which is called ACWI, which contains also the emerging markets. Sooner or later, there will also be index about frontier market.
I think there is one already, but it's very small.
Oh, really? Okay, it's very small.
And maybe it's synthetic on a swap basis. I'm not sure.
Yes, I mean, imagine going in all the buying stocks in every stock market for less than emerging countries. It's complicated. Yeah. There are other index companies like FTSE, FTSE, which is a subsidiary of London Stock Exchange. So there is MSCI, Standard & Poor's, FTSE, whatever. You decide which index. They probably shouldn't care much about the actual index. You should care about what the index means. Yeah. And then you try to, you see that there are several ETFs. An ETF has as an issuer. So who issued the ETF? Usually those are Vanguard, those are BlackRock/iShares, same company. There may be Spider, there may be State Street, there may be
Xtrackers, which is Deutsche Bank.
Xtrackers, yes, right, exactly. Yeah. Also UBS, Credit Suisse, other banks, Deutsche Banks.
Yeah. Yeah.
Those are not necessarily bad. They also issue passive funds. How to pick one? One key ingredient, I mean, there are several key ingredients. One is, for example, the cost, the recurring costs. So why we pick passive investing? Because we think that the strategy is better than active, especially when considering the cost of active investing. So a passive fund should invest according to an algorithm, not a smart algorithm. It's not AI trading. It's just every first of the month, drop the money on this. Okay. So this can be done programmatically with very low cost, which means behind an ETF, there's not like a lot of people in suited and with a tie, getting paid billions of money. So the costs are very, very low. You can find ETFs with 0.03% costs per year. And you maybe we can attach a resource where that shows you the difference in with 0.1, 0.2, 1% fee, what happens in your lifetime of investing. So one thing you should minimize is costs.
Recurring. It's a total expense ratio. That's how it's
and it's called TER, total expense ratio. So this, the lower, the better.
Can I mention one short thing
while
we're there? And when you look at the cost on just ETF, you can select a couple of ETFs on the index that you want to track. And then you can check the performance over the longest period of time that they match, basically. And so for me, exactly. The total expense ratio is not the only important thing, but basically the tracking difference in the end. So really, how close are they to tracking the index? And then you can actually see the actual performance, since the total expense ratio is something that you never see on your account. It's just basically
it's internal. Getting
exactly
out of your fund every month without you knowing, but it has to be announced and it has to be compliant with what they say on the fact sheet on ETF. Of course, there is a the index error, like the tracking error. So and Vanguard issues an ETF claiming that it tracks this index. But then what are the index performances and what are
sometimes
the fund performances?
Even better than the. So it depends. There are years where they're even better. So they have a very good tracking difference.
Because you cannot, it's very hard to replicate exactly an index. Maybe an index is updated every day, but the fund doesn't move the money every day. And then let's say that tonight there is a stock which is outside the top 500, and tomorrow at closure it gets 10x and jumps into the SP 500. Maybe my fund will get this stock in a month when they rebalance. So it's hard to track. And then also owning exactly the entire market might be difficult for small funds. So one thing that helps is getting fund with a large asset base. Like it's called AUM, asset under management. And I usually aim to things which are larger than 100 million, but even in the billions, it's better. So if your fund is small, there are several issues. One is that it might not track the index exactly for the best or for the worst. Usually it's for the worst. I don't know why, but it should be pretty random. And then you have a tracking error. And second, if the fund is small, you might have less people trading it. So when you want to sell, you need to accept a higher bid-ask spread, because if there are only three shares and I want to sell one, who am I selling to? Maybe not. There are not many people interested. You see that if you trade very large funds, you have bid and ask spread when you want to buy or sell that are like so close together, and that usually should not impact much your strategy because we are buying and holding forever. Remember?
Yes.
Then distributing and accumulating, does it matter in your country?
In my country, yeah. In most countries in Europe, I would say yes. And in my country also, it's just easier and more tax efficient to choose an accumulating version. Because so what does an accumulating ETF do? It just reinvests the dividends that it receives from the companies inside the index. It reinvests them regularly into the fund and buys more shares of the same companies. And what would you do if they're paid out? Usually what happens is you pay taxes right away when you receive the money, or you have to pay taxes in that tax year if you have to do the tax returns yourself. and then you have that money minus the taxes available to reinvest?
In Switzerland, you don't get taxed on capital gains. So accumulating stuff is a cheat to the system. So you can also say you have a business and your business generates a lot of revenue. You encapsulate it under a stock that is growing without ever distributing. That's a cheating. And the tax office knows it. So they will tax you anyway. So even for if an ETF is accumulating their dividend and reinvesting within the ETF, so buying other shares, the tax office will issue a virtual dividend and say, the underlying assets of this fund probably distributed like 2% dividend this year, so you get taxed. So it usually shouldn't matter. There are other issues, by the way. Here, this is a bit complicated because countries where companies operate, they usually take a withholding tax. So let's say you have Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola operates in US. So when they issue a dividend, the US government is taking 15 or 30%, depending if you are a US citizen or not, so depending which form you file. And then the other 85% goes to the ETF. And then the ETF distributed those money, and then you get taxed on that. But you lost the original amount. So there are combination of your residency, your broker residency, the ETF domicile, and stocks like companies domicile that can make things complex. This is a bit more complicated topic. In general, dividends are not very efficient in general. But that's probably not a topic for today.
And that's also why a lot of ETFs are domiciled in Ireland, because they have very good tax treaties with the US and many other countries. So they can reduce this tax to a minimum.
So my strategy in Switzerland is that I invest in a US domiciled ETF when the underlying assets are American, so that I can recap this 15% by filing a specific form, and then I get taxed on the dividends by the Swiss government on the whole dividend without having 50% stolen by the US government. If you buy an ETF which is distributing but domiciled somewhere else, you might get double taxed. There's an amazing article on the Boglehead Forum, so the Vanguard Investors Forum, that explains all the three level of dividend taxation, and that's amazing. But this may be some micro optimization, but you should care about it, because if S&P 500 has a dividend yield of 2%, on those 2% you will pay an income tax of, let's say, 30-35%, 20, depends on the country. So let's say 30% is in Austria, if I remember correctly.
It's 27.5%.
27.5. So it means you have another 0.55%. If your ETF issues a 2% dividend yield, and you pay 27.5%, it's in the end at 0.55%, which is much larger than the total expense ratio. So maybe you should optimize also for dividends, like maybe investing in things in growth stocks or whatever. But that's very personal. I like dividends because I'm old and I have like a lot of money. I don't care about being taxed, but I want to see cash flowing. I don't care about investing in the next, like, to the moon, but no dividends. So that's very personal. What else? How to physically buy a stock? But this is like very broker specific. So how to issue an order? There are different type of orders. I don't know if you want to go there. I don't think it's worth for this. That's too much.
Yeah, it might be a bit too much specific. Now going into detail. And that maybe is better if you can show it on screen or something, how to issue. And I also did some videos on how you can buy an ETF on Interactive Brokers on that interface.
Okay, then now we sent money to our broker. We bought our first bunch of shares. And now that's the problem is that time is passing and every month I have another 1,000 euros going to my brokerage account. How do you do this? How do you handle this? You need to reinvest.
Yes. So for example, if you're in most countries in Europe, or even if you have an IB account, then you buy manually. So when your money arrives on the brokerage account, you can, for example, for yourself, you can define a certain day each month where you buy it. You say my money arrives from my job on this date, and then on this day I buy the ETF. And I think the best
I'm annoyed by how many people like asking me, hey, is there a way to make automation on IB? It's boring to do three clicks. Come on, it's your money. I mean, unless it's for behavioral purposes, you don't want to be there and pick the exact price. But it's not a huge deal. It's not a huge deal.
I have to say, when it comes to this, we're lucky in Austria and Germany. The brokers, they got used to the local market that people like these savings plans. And there you can just say, okay, I want to invest 1,000 euro on the first of the month, and it buys exactly the amount of shares and even partial shares of the ETF.
Okay.
And it can even take it directly from your bank account. So we are very...
But then you cannot use your like monthly deposit to rebalance. What is rebalance, by the way?
You could change your savings plan. You can always do that. It's not okay. Fixed. You can cancel it anytime. Yeah.
So let's say you decided to pick a strategy that 50% invest in US stocks and 50% on Japanese stocks. You don't care about the rest of the world. You have this strategy, 50%, 50%. But then what happened? Like in the next month, US stock doubled, Japan stocks halved. Now you have 4-to-1 ratio. And then you have, it's next month. You have another extra 1,000 to invest. And then you have a huge imbalance in your portfolio. If you still believe that you want to invest 50% and 50%, you should now rebalance. So selling the assets who appreciated and buying the assets who depreciated. Maybe you need to also rethink about your strategy because 50% US and 50% Japanese is not the best strategy in the world. Usually, at the beginning, you rebalance. You don't get in 1 month a doubling of something and a halving of something else. You usually get your extra 1,000 to invest, and you would want to invest this money, if you do it manually, on the asset which is lower compared to the target. So if something
tax efficient.
So if one of your ETFs is not doing great, you invest more money in it. That's a way to try to buy low. But this is not better than just throwing random money at random places because we are not timing the market. But usually rebalancing reduces volatility. So if you had a portfolio like 60% stocks and 40% bonds, you would have survived all the crashes better than just 100% stocks in the mid-short term. In the long term, of course, the riskier, the better. Anyway, this is the concept of rebalancing. Automation. I'm in Switzerland. I use Interactive Brokers. I have an automation from my bank to IB. So I usually send 5,000 per month from my bank to IB a few days after I receive the paycheck. And then I go manually on IB. And actually, I don't invest that 5K because they just arrive on top of a lot of money that need to be invested. So I'm, holy shit, I have another 5K to allocate. I'm still sitting on a lot of cash. I don't know what to do. But usually you get this money and then you manually decide what to buy for Interactive Brokers. Oof, okay. I think we touched a lot of topics, mm-hmm. Angelo. Maybe it's too much.
I hope not. Let's
give our audience a break.
I hope you got a bit of an idea on how to start and how to get started with investing into stocks and ETFs. In the end, the strategy you go with, that's completely up to you. We just shared our personal view. And since I didn't mention it again, like for my own strategy is very simple, just one ETF. That's the Vanguard FTC All World. More broad, right?
Yes, yeah, sure. But I'm trying to do things more manually. I'm getting to know myself better, and I like more value stocks, which means like stocks that don't aim to the moon, but just I'm going to sell product. I mentioned Coca-Cola many times. I own Coca-Cola personally, but I also own ETFs who own Coca-Cola or other boomer stocks. So I have value ETF, dividend ETF. I'm trying to be broad, but also tilted towards some of the factors that I like more. And that's only based on my age and my current position in my career and my loss aversion. So, but yes, anyway.
Okay, now you have the ETF that you want. You found it maybe on Just ETF. And then you want to get started. You can open the account on Interactive Brokers. So these are just some that we know and that we have used and that we are satisfied with. So what I can say, we have Giorgio really likes Interactive Brokers. I also like them a lot. And for me, for most of my audience, I know that if they go, for example, if they don't have a large portfolio of over 100K, or if you're not investing a lot every month, then taking a look at introducing brokers like CapTrader can be a good idea, because then you can save this monthly inactivity fee. If it could be that you invest once a large amount, and then you just want the money to be invested for a long period, and so it wouldn't make sense to pay this amount until you reach 100K in total.
Yeah, I think if you have less than maybe even 50, maybe already at 50,000, maybe Interactive Brokers can break even compared to other brokers. But if you have like 10,000 or 5,000, you just want to start, it doesn't make sense to pay high fees.
And you can always switch directly to IB after. I think there's a couple months lockup period where you're basically not straight just IB, but you have the same interface and everything.
So it's a
you can switch afterwards. So it's not forever a decision.
Okay.
Great, and then we have another broker in Europe that is often used and mentioned is DEGIRO. And as I said, they were purchased by the Flatex Bank, which I think is a good thing, because now they get the additional banking license for the euro deposits, which they didn't have before. Before it was all in a money market fund. And then we said, okay, eToro and Trading212, I'm not a huge fan. And just make sure you see exactly what does your broker offer, what does it not offer, and just to make sure that you're making a good long-term decision. And maybe I'm wrong, maybe they are fantastic brokers, but just something to look into more closely.
Too many scammy advertisements about it, or too bombarded by ads. I don't like that.
And then the last exception, if you're in Austria or Germany, as I said before, look into Flatex. If you're in Austria, they're pretty much without alternatives, in my opinion. From a cost perspective and from what they offer. And then in Germany, you have some other low-cost options. And I'm going to put one summary link where you can see the different German and Austrian brokers that I use and have accounts with. Since we mentioned rebalancing as well, for me, I like to, since we don't have the same advantage tax situation like in Switzerland, when it comes to rebalancing, keep the taxes in mind. Something that I would do is use fresh money to rebalance. And as you mentioned, buy the one that was that didn't go up in value as much, just to put your asset allocation back in order. And that could even mean that maybe your asset allocation means, oh, I'm actually, instead of bonds, maybe I want to have 10% cash. And I can say, okay, I'm going to rebuild my cash buffer a little bit. So maybe you can take advantage of a crash opportunity if the stock market went up a lot. So that's something that you
makes sense. About. Okay, guys.
So, I think we covered a lot.
Yeah, it's been an amazing episode, Angelo. I think it's easy to tell among us. I hope you guys enjoy our chat. And we are gonna record another one next week, and then we'll see. Leave us feedback and smash the like button and subscribe. How's that? Exactly. You're more expert.
So thank you guys so much for watching. And if you enjoyed the video, don't forget to smash the like button and subscribe if you want to see more videos. And also you can find all the links that we mentioned in the description below, which is also a way that you can support us when you use those links. And in addition, I'm going to try to get our videos up on podcasting platforms, since I know some people asked about that. And so hopefully by Wednesday, when this video comes out, we should be also findable via Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Podcasts and stuff like this. So hopefully that's going to work out. And I'm also going to try and add some timestamps. Since I know you asked for that, then it's going to be easier to jump around, since we covered a lot of stuff again in this video.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, guys. Bye-bye.
Thanks so much for watching. Bye.